Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with actor Matt DeCaro, who's here as part of the ensemble company performing in Rhinoceros, currently playing at the Oslo Repertory Theatre and directed by the brilliant Frank Galati. Matt also appears in Shakespeare in Love, which is running concurrently. Matt's story is really interesting, because although he knew what he needed to be and what he needed to do from the very beginning of his life, it wasn't an easy road. Listen to this dedicated, passionate man talk about how he held on to his dream in the face of resistance. It's a really interesting story, so hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
To The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you should be. Not the person other people are. Not the person other people told you you had to be. And for many of us, not even the person you think you are. Because unfortunately, so many people had experiences in their childhoods that told them that something about themselves was not okay. And they learned to deny that so well that they actually forgot that they had those aspects, those qualities, those curiosities, those interests, and came into adulthood not having access to all of who they were. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And it is my hope that when you hear them, you will be inspired to ask if you are actually the person you really are. And if you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynneshow.com, thelynneshow. The artist I've interviewed in today's show is, as I said in the run-up, Matt DeCaro. And his story is inspiring. So here now is the actor, Matt DeCaro. Okay, so I'm here with Matt DeCaro, and he is appearing in Rhinoceros and Shakespeare in Love as part of the Oslo Repertory Theatre season. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. So I'm assuming that the art to which you are giving your life and perhaps making your living is the art of acting. Would that be accurate?
It would be 100% accurate.
Okay, good. So I only have one question.
Wow, okay.
Yes, and it is, do you remember and can you tell me the very first time in your life when acting, play acting, storytelling, pretending, any of that captured you, looked good to you, became interesting to you?
Yes. I'm somebody that always knew this is what I wanted to do.
Okay, so at 2, at 4, at 6?
Probably 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my cousin taking me to see Snow White at the movie theater. And I must have been 3 or 4. I was in kindergarten, so 4. And I remember just being mesmerized by the three godmothers and the colors of it, and the color of those three fairy-like people and the sparkle of their wands. And
But wait a minute, I just want to say, it's clear to me that you can see it today, you know, that it's so burned into your memory that it's still very, very real to you, no?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a year or so later, my mother and my aunts took all of us to a children's theater, Drury Lane Martinique, and they did a children's theater, and it was Peter Pan. And I remember coming into the theater, and it was so beautiful, and they had a pond in the lobby with koi fish and colored lights. And I remember just thinking that that was the best thing in the world, to see the fish in the pond and the colored lights. And then we went into the theater, and there was Peter Pan being done. And it was very much like the color and the excitement of seeing Snow White. And I was like, I don't want to be anywhere else but this magical place with these lights, and it's so beautiful. Of course, Mary Martin's Peter Pan was on television in black and white, and was very, and it was a big event when we were children, when it would come on TV, and I was always mesmerized by that. And then they were doing a community theater production in the neighborhood of Peter Pan, and I remember all the adults talking about auditioning for it, and I remember going to see it and thinking it was just the best thing in the world. And my mother was a big fan, she was a huge movie fan, and in those days, in the 60s, on the local television channels, you could see movies round the clock. The old 30s and 40s and 50s movies, and a lot of times my mother would be like, she would call me, I'd be playing out in the street, and she would, you know, with the other kids, and she'd call me in, and she'd be like, Dark Voyager is on, it's a classic, we've got to watch it. And I would sit with my mother, and I'd watch all these Betty Davis movies, and all these Joan Crawford movies, and but then, you know, I got interested in them myself, and I was like looking at Jimmy Cagney and Humphrey Bogart and, you know, John Wayne and all of them, Jimmy Stewart and Spencer Tracy. I became just like, anytime Spencer Tracy was in a movie, I was like, wow, what is he doing?
Now we're talking like 6, 7, 10, 12, like that, all through
grade school. And I couldn't wait. I couldn't figure out how I was going to get an opportunity to be on stage myself.
Okay, I just want to stop you and ask a question. You said when they were doing Peter Pan in the community theater production, the adults were talking about auditioning. Who?
Just my aunt Marie, my mother's twin sister, did it once at the Park District, but not that play. She did Little Foxes, as a matter of fact. She played Birdies in Little Foxes. And I didn't see it. They didn't take me to see Aunt Marie do it. But I remember when it was happening, I think I might have been 6 or 7 at that time.
Okay, but what this says to me is that it's not just that you saw these things being done by, you know, in the movies or on stage, but you actually knew somebody who either did it or wanted to do it. You knew that it was an option.
Yes.
No? Yeah, yes. You're right? Right.
Yes.
Okay, so when you say, I'm wondering when I'm going to be able to do it, you had reason to believe that you could someday do it.
I guess that's what they mean by privilege, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Although my neighborhood was not very arty. I mean, I came from a very blue-collar background.
But your mother was pretty arty, wasn't she?
My mother was, yes.
Yes.
My mother very much was.
Sure, the neighborhood is not nearly so impactful as the mother.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's very true. That is really true.
Okay, so when was the first opportunity you had to...
Well, my cousin went to Niles North High School, which had an extraordinary theater program, and I had a cousin who got all the leading roles in her high school, and we would go and see Margaret, and I was like, I want to do that so bad.
Were you talking about this, or this was just inside you, your desire to do it?
I don't think I ever talked about it to
anybody.
No.
Do you know, I'm just curious, do you know why?
Well, it wasn't something that boys did in my neighborhood.
Yes. Oh, no, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Were they talking to you? Well, you were so young. I mean, they weren't talking to you about what you might do.
My mother was always talking to us about what we might do. My mother wanted us to be doctors.
Then she shouldn't have been calling you in to watch the movies all the time.
I know.
That was a mistake on her part.
Well, what are you going to do?
No, right, absolutely. So you, again, you get to see actual people that you know doing it, so you know it's an option.
Yes.
Okay, so when do you get to try it?
When I was a freshman in high school.
Oh, you had to wait till then.
Yes. Well, I tried not to wait till then. I tried to get the nuns at our grammar school to do a play, and they wouldn't do it. And I said, well, how about a variety show then? And they were like, okay, do a variety show. So the nuns let me produce and MC a variety show.
In elementary school?
When I was in eighth grade, yeah. So I produced this variety show with a bunch of kids, with a bunch of the rest of the kids that the nuns had chosen to do. I didn't have any talent, so I couldn't do anything, so I just kind of put it together and was the MC for it. And
the producing and the MCing is a talent. I don't know how to break it to you, but I understand that.
Well, there were a ton of kids that could actually do stuff. I mean, they could, you know, twirl a baton and play the accordion. And,
right.
But then we went to Catholic high schools. My sister was a junior at Queen of Peace, and I was a freshman at St. Lawrence. And my sister was doing Pride and Prejudice, and they needed boys. So she sent me to the nun who was directing. So the first play I ever did was Pride and Prejudice. I played Colonel Guy Fitzwilliams when I was a sophomore in high school. And then...
Did you like it? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember vividly. I loved it. Yeah.
So you knew that you were right.
I always knew it was what I wanted to do.
That's amazing.
I know, it kind of is. And all my life long, my other, you know, my pals, my other kids growing up in high school and college, they were always like, you're so lucky, you know what you want to do. I have no idea what I want to do. And I was like, I'm doing this.
There wasn't a drama class in your Catholic high school.
No, but there were two men who did plays. And those two teachers were extremely encouraging to me and taught me a lot when they cast me. And then they arranged for me two scholarships, one to Quincy College and one to the Goodman School.
So you had said to them, this is what I want to do.
Well, they had said to me, you know, we've been doing this for many years and we don't often see somebody who we think can do it. And we think you can do it.
And this is before you had said to them, I want to do it.
You don't say things like that to your teachers in those days. You just sort of...
I see. But they could see that not only you could do it, but that you wanted to do it. They could see the passion in you, right? Okay, so...
Well, that was extraordinarily encouraging to me.
That's amazing, actually.
But with the scholarships that they got for me, my father wouldn't let me take them. My father was in a fury. He just was not having it. So...
Oh, my.
So he was like, you're going down to the University of Illinois and you're going to get a degree in something you can make a living at, and I don't want to hear any more of this bullshit about acting.
Yeah, right.
And who do you think you are? You're not good looking enough to be an actor.
Oh, my God. Right.
And he was in a blind fury for several years.
Years?
Years.
Well, did you do what he asked?
For college, I did.
And he was still mad?
Well, he thought I was going to get over it. I didn't do any plays when I was in college. I did one. I snuck out to do it.
Oh, my.
But I didn't know what to do, what to major in. And my sister was like, be an education major. You'll get a degree in education. You can, mommy and daddy will be happy. There's no language requirement. You're a boy. They'll pass you because you're a boy. Just do that. So I did that. Some friends who had been former students of my teacher's school had opened a theater company in New York, and they were like, come to New York to help us do this theater company. I was like, I can't. I got to go to college. And they kept writing back and forth and calling. And in those days, the plane fare was cheap, and some weekends I would go to New York and see what was going on.
Oh, you must have been miserable.
I was very miserable. But I did the program in 3 years. Because I was, and I didn't care about the grades, I just cared about getting the credits to get the degree. And I got good at being a student, which I had never been good at. So I gave my degree to my parents. My father put me up against the wall. He was just so furious. So I got on the plane to New York. They had opened Long Day's Journey into Night above some Irish bar on 2nd Avenue in New York in the dead of winter and lost all their money. So by the time I got there, there was no theater.
Nothing.
So I got a job at Lord & Taylor's as a collector. And I was too afraid to ride the subways. I would walk from, miles to work every day. And I lasted 6 weeks, and I came home. And I was in my bedroom for about 4 or 5 days. And my mother was like, you have to come out now. You've got your degree. Go down and be a substitute teacher. So I wound up substitute teaching. And I was like, and I kept getting called to a special education school, which I really liked. And I thought, well, I'll go back to school and get my certificate to be a special education teacher. So I would teach all day. We were done at 2:30, then classes started on campus at 3:30 to 6:30. So then one day my sister picked me up and drove me down to the University of Chicago, to the Reynolds Club. And she said, they're having auditions in there. Go in and audition.
Oh, your sister.
I know, right? And I got the role. So then I got involved in the theater community at the University of Chicago, and I would substitute all day, do the graduate program, and then go to rehearsal all night.
Oh, God.
And Nick Ruddle was a classics professor at the university and an actor, and he was going to put in a rep company on campus at the UFC, and he looked at all of us. He was like, you chaps are great. You need more training. So I called my friends in New York. I was like, where do I go to get training? They were like, there are only two places, Yale or ACT in San Francisco or the Royal Academy in London. The ACT audition, they said, be at the Palmer House in Chicago on this date to audition. So I went to the Palmer House, and the lady said, and what schools are you going to apply to? And I was like, ACT. And she said, and who else? I was like, nobody else. And she was like, what if you don't get in? I was like, then I won't go. And she was like, don't be crazy. Walk in and audition for everybody. It was a league of professional actor training programs. So I auditioned for everybody. And the University of Washington in Seattle was my best offer. So I went. And it was really my training at the University of Washington, which was a conservatory very much like this conservatory here, that gave me a foundation. Came back to Chicago and I was teaching again, and then I got offered to teach acting at the Arts High School, which I did for a couple of years, and then I wound up as the chairman of that department for about 15 years.
And were you not acting on the side?
I was. The board of directors of that school wanted the students to be engaged with people who were actively...
Yeah, they wanted professionals.
Yes.
So you were a teacher, but you were also an actor.
Yeah, I would teach all day and then act all night. I did that for many, many years. But then I did start getting more and more work out of town.
Well, yeah, and let's talk about Rhinoceros. It's a difficult role. Even physically, it's a difficult role, no?
Yeah, I wish I was 10 years younger doing it.
No kidding. Yeah. No kidding. So talk about the play in case there's somebody who's listening who hasn't seen it yet.
Well, the play is an absurdist comedy about group thinking, about how we're infected by others, about the way we think. We know Ionesco wrote it as a in response to the fascism that he saw in his lifetime in the 30s.
Yeah, creeping.
Creeping up, and how people just become infected by this groupthink. So in this play, we see two friends, and one is a kind of stuffy, pedantic, pseudo-intellectual, affected person, and then later in the play we see him actually turn into a rhinoceros. Mm-hmm. And that's the physical part of the show that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because it should be comic, but an arduous journey in that scene to change from a human being into a fascist animal. And I think Mr. Galati, our director, who is one of the great men of the American theater, wanted it to be scary and spooky too.
Yeah, it was. I didn't think it was that funny, actually. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, Zero Mostel won a Tony for it in 1962, but in 1962, it was a celebration, I think, of overcoming fascism. I think our thinking about it now is less funny, and I think both Frank and I wanted it to be a little less funny.
The play is fascinating, and the acting is amazing. So you were saying that about the two characters.
Yes, David.
Yes.
And David Breitbart plays Beringer, and he's every man, and he resists turning into a rhinoceros. I mean, the role I play is very flashy, but David's role, for one thing, David is on stage for the entire play.
Yes.
And it takes a lot out of him. He's much more exhausted than I am at
the
end of it. And he gives a beautiful performance of the pain that Ionesco must have experienced seeing the world around him change into this vicious place. And the strength to not participate.
Well, and to be alone.
And to be alone. And David's performance is just stunning in it, I think.
And for me, I mean, I don't know whether this is accurate or not, but I didn't see him as the one who would do that. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, because he was such a flawed...
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. For him to be the one with the strength, I thought that was extraordinary. And
well, it just goes to what art always speaks to, is that our vulnerabilities are our strengths.
Yes, yes.
And
of course, then it's hopeful, isn't it, that...
Yes.
Right?
That even flawed people can be heroic.
Yes.
And the rest of the cast is...
Everybody.
Pitch perfect.
Yeah, everybody is wonderful. It's wonderful. Yeah. It's a wonderful play. You are wonderful in it.
Well, thank you.
No, truly, you are. Well, so I only have one more question.
Sure.
And it is, given how much time in your life that you have been attached to, interested in, compelled by performance, acting, what would you say about what that's like?
I have no regrets about it whatsoever. But the rewards of it have been very, very different than I thought they would be. I feel like my life has been extraordinarily enriched by it and by the people. Every time I think about quitting or stopping or doing something else, I can't let go of my tribe. I need to be with my fellows, with my comrades. And one of the things that's been incredibly rewarding about it, which I never anticipated, was the stories themselves. Living these stories year after year after year after year has a cumulative effect on you interiorly, which I never thought about.
Yes, you didn't realize the impact it would have on you as a person.
Yes.
Right? You were thinking of what you were going to be doing, but not what you were going to be receiving. I've never heard anybody say that.
And living these beautiful stories has been so rewarding. When you start, when you're young, you always hope you're going to be a movie star. You know, you always hope you're going to win an Academy Award. You spend a lot of time daydreaming about what you would say in your acceptance. We all do that. And I'm kind of grateful that that did not happen for me. I like how it is now. But the main reward has been
the personal growth. I can see it. And I think that is a really good place to stop.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Really.
I don't ever get to talk about myself. Thank you.
Well, it was a pleasure to listen to you. You should do it more often.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. As I said in the run-up, I always hope that when you listen to someone like Matt, is there something I always wanted to be or do that I am not being or doing? Do I feel about my life the way Matt feels when he's acting? And if the answer to that is yes, well, congratulations. But if the answer to that is no, it may not be too late to recover some important aspect of yourself which you had to hide even from yourself. And again, you can talk to me about that at my website, thelinshow.com. As always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that inspired you, something that amused you, something that'll bring you down to see rhinoceros, something that'll bring you back, because next week I will be back, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So